And remember, I was mentioning to you earlier that we need to meet for a few minutes right after the service tonight. We'll just meet right down here about a practical matter we got to get resolved. Nothing anybody needs to worry about. Chris is having an issue with the bank, and it's a procedural thing with the bank, and so we're probably going to change banks, and so it's just some paperwork thing. but anyway, deacons meet for a few minutes to talk about that this evening. One thing Chris wouldn't realize is, you know, our a cappella group, Arioso, that sings at Biltmore, we're going again this year for, I think, the fifth year now, that we're going to sing at the Biltmore in November. We're going to be here for Christmas dinner, too, by the way. I got confirmation for that from everybody Friday night. All but one of us can be here for that. So for the Christmas dinner in December, Arioso is going to come and sing our set of Christmas music that we do at the Biltmore. Anyway, when we go to the Biltmore, we'll wear formal wear, and I'll wear a black tux and these socks. they let me in. They've never stopped me at the door because of the Red Sox. We have to go through a back door, though. But they do make us come in through the servants' entrance. If you need a copy of the outline, if you didn't get one, wave your hand there. Anybody need that? All right, tonight we're coming back to the book of Ezra. In 537 B.C., about 50,000 Israelites had returned to Judea, filled with expectations of a glorious future as they're coming back to rebuild the city and rebuild the temple of God, reclaim their national heritage. In the first year and a half after their arrival, they made a lot of progress. They got the altar rebuilt. They resumed the sacrifices. They resumed the celebration of all the holy days. They laid the foundation of the temple. They had a big celebration for its completion. But then they had a group of people show up from their area and the neighboring provinces and say, "We want to help." But these were apostate people, and they said, "You know, we don't need your help. This is something that the king has decreed for us to do." And so those people revealed their true motives. They launched a campaign to stop the project, and they succeeded. And Ezra 4 closed with the notification that work on the house of God in Jerusalem, the last verse of Ezra 4, then work on the house of God in Jerusalem ceased, and it was stopped until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Now, pivoting on that statement, chapter 5 opens in the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. It's 17 years later. There's a 17-year gap between the end of chapter 4 and chapter 5. Cyrus has died. His son and successor, Cambyses, has died without mention in this book. There was an attempted coup by a usurper, according to the Persian records, who claimed to be the deceased heir named Smerdis. And so historians simply refer to him as pseudo-Smerdis. They don't know who he was, a guy who pretended to be Smerdis, who had died earlier, either by suicide or by assassination. Well, the new ruler of the Persian Empire is now Darius, and Darius had been one of the generals, or the chief general of the Persian army. And as we're going to see in the next couple of chapters, the Jews are going to find it providential through the actions of God in the background that Darius was a great admirer of Cyrus. He thought that Cyrus was the best thing that ever happened to the empire. He was the founder of the empire. Darius sets out in his own reign to emulate Cyrus, and he even sets out to reinstate some of Cyrus's policies that had been forsaken under his successor. So that's going to prove to be beneficial for the Jews. Now, he doesn't repeat the time marker with which the fourth chapter closed. Ezra just starts chapter 5 with a reference to two prophets, giving credit to God's use of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah as the reason the work on the temple was finally resuming. Kidner makes an insightful comment. He says, like every spiritual advance from Abraham's to the missionary expansion in Acts, this venture began with a word from the Lord. And so we'll see that as we go. I'll read this in sections as we go. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Father, we ask that you would bless our study of your word tonight as we examine this chapter from the historical record of Ezra. And we pray that you would help us to understand what happened, but also help us to see your hand at work among your people. and understand the lessons that you have for us from our study tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, they're resuming the temple's reconstruction. Now it's 520 BC. The 17 years have passed. It's in the second year of Darius. God has called Haggai and Zechariah to rekindle Israel's zeal for the work. We've already seen that in our study of the messages of those prophets. Haggai's were all delivered during a period of time, a very brief period of time. Edwin Yamauchi identifies it very specifically. He says it began on August 29th, 520 BC, and it ended December 18th of that same year. That's when Haggai ministered. It's a very specific period of time. We can date him more specifically than any of the other Old Testament prophets. About 2 months after Haggai's first message, after his first proclamation, Zechariah begins with a very similar message, right there tucked in between, right in the middle of Haggai's ministry. Haggai's first message had rebuked the repatriated Israelites for having become self-centered and apathetic toward the work. And within less than a month of his preaching, they had started working again. They had the project back up and running. And Zechariah's first message was similar, but it was to spur them on with a message of encouragement to keep it up. Keep it up, because they'd already gotten started about a month before Zechariah is introduced. Along with that, he gave them some threats of consequences if they would falter. His final climactic message was filled with promises of great and glorious future, but we don't know how far out that was time-wise, when the Messiah would come and reign over the world in that day, in the day of the Lord. You see, Zechariah's messages, as I said before, were focused more on the coming kingdom than had Haggai. Haggai's emphasis had been on the need to obey God and get the work done. Zechariah's message emphasized not so much the obedience to God's instructions, although that was related. He was emphasizing the need to believe God's promises. We've already discussed all of that in our study of those two prophets. Ezra notes here that they preached to the Jews in Jerusalem. But the one fact that Ezra considers most important when he comes back, when we come back to Ezra's record, notice that he really doesn't say much about what they preached, about what they said, and he doesn't say much about how they preached. What he says is one thing. He says, when the prophets Haggai and the prophet Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, who was over them. That's what he considered most significant, that they prophesied in the name of the God of Israel who was over them in the first verse here of chapter 5. You see, when they got up and preached, they did not claim personal authority. They did not claim political authority. They declared that they had received a word from the Lord. And they were delivering the message God had given them. They identified the divine source, the divine authority of what they preached. Now, the pronoun them is a little ambiguous. Does he mean that they preached in the name of the God of Israel who was over Haggai and Zechariah? Or does he mean more broadly? It may be either one. If he's referring specifically to the prophets, then he means that they preached under God's control. He had commissioned them, and it was his message they were delivering. We know that that was true, certainly. But it's also possible, maybe probable, that he's referring to this a little more broadly, that the them refers back to the Jews that were in Jerusalem. And Judah and Jerusalem. In which case, what Ezra's saying here is that God's authority over his people was being exercised by the ministry through the prophets. They preached the name of the God who was over all of them. Both of those things are true, and we shouldn't try to parse that too closely. The end result is that Israel obeyed either way. But that's what Ezra sees fit to mention here. He doesn't tell us what they actually preached. Now, then we're told in verse 2 that Zerubbabel and Jeshua obeyed and resumed construction. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, son of Jozadak, arose and began to rebuild the house of God which is in Jerusalem. And the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. Now again, Ezra once again identifies Zerubbabel as the son of Shealtiel, which Shealtiel was the oldest son of King Jehoiakim, who had been king of Israel, the rightful heir of David, when they were taken into captivity in Babylon. And so Zerubbabel was a descendant of David's line and probably the rightful heir to the throne of Israel. Earlier, he's been identified in this book earlier as the man that Cyrus had appointed as the governor of Judea. Now, Jeshua, here, the prophets didn't call him Jeshua. The prophets called him Joshua. In Haggai and Zechariah, they spelled it differently. It's the same guy. He's the high priest. He's the son of, here he's called the son of Jozadak. The prophets give the fuller name Jehozadak. It's just a variant spelling of the name of his father. It's the same guy. It's not an inaccuracy. It's just a quirk of the Hebrew language that allows those abbreviated forms of those names sometimes. And so he is identified as the high priest. Haggai had identified him as a high priest as well. Now, when it says here in Ezra that the two of them arose and began to build, we should not picture these two guys getting out there with crowbars and sledgehammers and doing the work themselves. It doesn't necessarily mean they weren't involved, but they weren't out there the only ones doing it. It means that those two guys in command of the Jews in Jerusalem and Judea got everybody back to work. Under their leadership, the people got back to work, including the involvement of all the Jews in the region. Included the involvement of all the Jews in the region, not the Jews that didn't come home, but the Jews that were there, were involved with the rebuilding project. It's consistent with what the prophets said. Ezra also explicitly notes that the work was accompanied by the ongoing support of the prophets. I think it's interesting that one commentator, Stevenson, who teaches at Bob Jones Seminary, he says that the prophets of God here was an unknown group also engaged in a prophetic ministry who at this time joined Haggai and Zechariah in stirring up the people to renewed work. I'd say that's possible, but it seems like it's an awfully speculative way to interpret this. There's nothing in the text that indicates that the prophets who were supporting the work is anybody other than Haggai and Zechariah. I don't think we need more prophets introduced to the picture to complete the picture. Stevenson may be right. Of the four commentaries I checked, he's the only one who offered that speculative interpretation there. Anyway, he might be right, but I don't think so. That he's interpreting that, I think, as an extension of the group that in Kings had been referred to as the sons of the prophets. There was kind of a seminary training program for people that were called the sons of the prophets. And I think he's just interpreting this as an extension of that group, and I don't see anything in the text that indicates support for that. Now, it would have been nice if Ezra could have stopped right there and just reported that the work got finished and everything was great. But once again, we see that the work on the temple is not going to progress without some form of opposition. And so they run into more difficulty now that they're getting started, another obstacle. The initial work had provoked all that opposition of their neighbors. This time, maybe they're because of the ongoing opposition of their neighbors, but we're not told exactly why. We see that with the resumption of the work now, it provoked an official investigation. We see it provoking an official investigation in verses 3 to 17, the rest of the chapter. It would have been virtually impossible for a project like this to go unnoticed in the kingdom. We think of the distances involved and so on, but this was still a kingdom that communicated quite effectively with remote regions. The Persians were noteworthy for having developed the first decent and practical and workable postal system in history. And I'll say more about that later. But they had a system that in America the later Pony Express patterned itself after. To get messages throughout the kingdom. We see a little more evidence of that in the book of Esther. We'll see that when we get there here shortly. But there was good communication. And what's going on here, if for no other reason, you now have suddenly a huge building project. You've got the Jews in Judea. All of a sudden, they're ordering building materials from other provinces. There's stone being quarried. There's lumber being harvested, and it's all being shipped into Judah. The Judeans are shipping out vast quantities of agricultural products to pay for these things, to trade for these building materials. And this is going to get noticed by a governor. By a satrap. The people in charge are going to notice all this transfer of building materials, and somebody's going to wonder, who authorized all this stuff? If this has been authorized by the king, it should have come through my office, and I haven't seen any paperwork. Okay? And, you know, bureaucracies are still the same, right? And so somebody wants to check it out. So we shouldn't be too surprised that there were officers in the chain of command above Zerubbabel who want to know on whose authority Zerubbabel is suddenly getting this major building operation going, and they want to check and see what's happening. And so they actually show up. You'll remember, you may not remember the details, but several weeks ago I explained in more detail than you wanted how the Persian Empire was organized. And that the whole empire was divided into territories called large territories called satrapies, with a satrap over as the officer over each one. Each satrapy was divided up into provinces, not exactly the way our states are divided into counties, but you get the idea. And Zerubbabel was governor there in Judea, in the province of Judea, but Judea was a small province within the larger province that had really two names, two sections. There was Babylon and the area across the Euphrates River called Abarnahara, which translates as Trans-Euphrates, or the land beyond the river. And there's the governor of that big satrap, apparently, the satrapy sent investigators. And so Persian officials, we see in the opening, in verses 3 and 4, Persian officials challenged Zerubbabel's authorization. At that time, Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar Bozenai and their colleagues came and spoke to them thus, "Who issued you a decree to rebuild this temple and to finish this structure?" Then we told them accordingly what the names of the men were who were reconstructing this building. Now, there are some issues with the translation of these two verses a little bit. I'll get into it in just a second. There are some critics. Well, first of all, let me note that if I'm Zerubbabel there in Judea, and the guy who shows up is identified as the regional governor, his visit unannounced is probably not good news. I'm probably not saying, "Oh, wow, you know, great, the governor shows up for this project." I'm probably getting a little nervous about his coming. He probably doesn't have, he probably didn't show up just to give me a pat on the back. There's something going on. Now, some critics have accused Ezra of getting his facts wrong. He identifies Tattenai as the Trans-Euphrates governor. The critics claim that according to the Persian records, and they're not wrong, the satrap over that region during the early years of Darius was a fellow whose name was Ushtanu, according to the Persian records. Well, it seems that once again they kind of jumped the gun, because further examination of the Persian records, according to A.T. Olmsted, who's quoted by several commentators, Olmsted says that that his examination of the Persian records indicated the satrapy of Babylon and Abarnahara, the Trans-Euphrates region, was governed by a satrap whose name was, in fact, Ushtanu. But Ushtanu had divided the satrap into two sections, Babylon and Trans-Euphrates, and he had appointed governors over each one, and the governor he appointed over Trans-Euphrates was, surprise, Tattenai. Okay, and so the Persian records do in fact support what this says. He didn't say he was a governor of the entire satrap. He says he was a governor of Trans-Euphrates. And so Tattenai shows up and comes to Jerusalem. He's accompanied by a guy who's called Shethar-Bozenai and others who came with them. It just translated as "and their colleagues." Now, Shethar-Bozenai might have been Tattenai's assistant. He might have been his secretary. That's what Brenneman suggests. Yamauchi says he was probably a Persian official. There are two different possible Persian officials he might have been. One official title was Patrafasra, and another one was Frasaka, and those are similar in their duties. The Patrafasa was an inquisitor, and the Frasaka was an investigator. Both of them would have investigative authority, kind of like special agents of the FBI showing up with him to investigate what's going on, or maybe the Treasury Department, Secret Service, coming to investigate what's happening here. They came with the authority to take into custody or to punish people if they were out of line. These guys come in. So there's an implied threat in their showing up. Now, who the rest of them were, we don't know. They may have just been the necessary support staff who would travel with such an august envoy. Well, when they get there, they demand to know who issued the decree. Now, they didn't say, you don't have the authority to do this. They didn't make a charge. They left open the possibility that there was, in fact, a valid decree that had gone unnoticed. But they want to know who issued the decree. I saw a little video the other day. Little girl had lipstick all over her mouth, and her dad had videoed this, and he asked her, did you ask if you could do this? She said, yes. He said, who did you ask? She says, I asked myself. Okay, so Zerubbabel, who told you could do this? Well, I asked myself. Okay, that's not going to get you very far, all right? The dad went on and asked her whose lipstick was. She says, it was mine. He says, it's yours? She says, yeah, I bought it. He says, where did you buy it? She says, Home Depot. She's got lipstick all over the place. It was pretty cute. Anyway, there's I think Tat and I thought he had caught Zerubbabel with lipstick all over his face, you know. Who told you could do this? And he expected him to say, I did it on my own authority. I asked myself. But that's not the answer he got. Tat and I knew that an authorization should have come through his office. And he hadn't seen any paperwork. And so he's suspicious. He has no idea that the decree was old enough. It would have come through that office long before he ever took the office. This is a 17, 18-year-old decree, or 20-year-old, almost a 20-year-old decree. It goes back a ways. It wasn't a newly issued permit. It was an old permit that had been issued by Cyrus himself. In the process, he asked them, who gave you, issued the decree to rebuild this temple and then to finish the structure? The word translated structure here has caused translators some difficulties. King James translates it wall. It's a word that it's a little unclear exactly what it means, but it has as its root a structure made from wood, which makes the wall of the city unlikely to be the target that they're asking about. But the temple itself was mostly made of stone too, although there were timbers involved, as we'll see as this discussion goes on. So we're not exactly sure what it's talking about. It's probably just kind of who told you could build this, rebuild the temple, and make this and get to where you're about to complete the building, the structure, the project. It's probably not talking about the fortification of the city, although some have thought that's what it meant. We're not exactly sure. Now, verse 4 is also causes some issues for translation challenges. Most translators end up modifying the Hebrew a little bit because the Hebrew as written is doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The pronoun in the Masoretic text is we, and the verb is asked. The King James comes out most literal, but it ends up saying that we asked them what are the names of the men who were doing the building. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Tatnai shows up and says, who issued you the decree? And we asked them who are the names of the people doing the work. That's literally what it says in the Masoretic text. The New American Standard assumes that the verb was miscopied, and so it turns it into a statement. We told them the names. Not we asked them the names, but we told them the names. However, in the letter that shows up, the text of the letter that Tatnai writes to the king is provided in this chapter. And within that letter, Tatnai claims, we asked them the names of the men who were doing the work. And so it seems more likely that the Septuagint and the Syriac translations of the Old Testament give us the correct reading, that there must have been a simple miscopying of a pronoun, that from we it should be they. They ask us, not we ask them. That they asked for those names, because Tatnai claims that's what he asked. And so that's how the ESV, the NIV, the Net Bible, and several others translate this. And so when you get to verse 4, you see it different in different translations. That's why. Because the literal translation doesn't make a lot of sense, and people are trying to find a way to make sense of what it says. Now, the way I've interpreted it is that they wanted the names of the men who were doing the building. They wanted a record, okay? Who are the people who are in charge of the construction here? And because if there's anybody who's going to get in trouble, we want to get the right guys. There's an implied threat. But we do get a hint that all is going to be well, because Ezra adds, but the eye of their God was on the elders of the Jews. And the eye of God, in this case, is an expression that refers to his providential watchfulness. He was watching over them. God was keeping an eye on his people. And so we find in verse 5 that he says that the eye of their God was on the elders of the Jews, and they did not stop them until the report could come to Darius, and then a written reply be returned concerning it. So what he says in verse 5 is that Tatnai determined he's going to write to Darius to find out whether our answer is going to be sufficient and prove to be true. And that's going to take some time to get to the king. They're going to have to search the archives looking for the edict. And then, presuming they can eventually find the edict, the king, or not, whatever the case may be, they give up the search. The king is going to have to write back to Tatnai with instructions. Now, how many officials do you know that would walk in on a building project and say, I don't think this thing's been authorized? And you say, yes, it is. It was authorized by Cyrus. And he says, I'm going to have to check it out. How many guys do you know who's going to say, okay, you guys just keep working until we hear back from them? Not many. Okay, and so Ezra says it was the eye of God upon his people that made Tatnai decide, you guys just stay at it. I'm going to take your word for it till the king tells me otherwise. That's kind of an unusual response. It was certainly not the response they might have expected. And so it was the providence of God that he did not stop the work. He let them continue instead of suspending the work until he got approval. It's really, frankly, remarkable that he would do such a thing. I believe then, too, that the people kept up the momentum because Haggai and Zechariah were still preaching, and all of this, they're still preaching there while Tatnai's there. And so all of this is still underway, and the momentum for this project continues while Tatnai's waiting for word back from the king. And he won't get that until chapter 6. So what we have in verses 6 to 17 for the rest of this chapter is the letter Tatnai sent the king. Ezra recorded his letter. He wrote it right into the text of his historical record. Edwin Yamauchi, in his commentary, mentions that in the 1930s, there was an excavation done in the ceremonial capital of the Persian Empire, which was a city called Persepolis. In the city of Persepolis, and by the way, the ceremonial capital was distinct from the political capital. The political capital is in Susa, which is where the events in Esther take place, in the political capital. But there was a ceremonial capital there too, where the king spent part of his time in Persepolis. But in the 1930s, the excavation, they found several thousand tablets and fragments dating from the 13th to the 30th years of Darius that are consistent in style and content to the writing of Tatnai. and the letter that he sent, and to his tone, his vocabulary, with the text that we have here. The historians who scoff at this record here as if it were a fabrication really stumble over the discoveries of the 1930s in Persepolis, because it gives support to what this record provides. The tone of this letter is way different from the tone of the letter that we saw earlier, when the written by the Samaritans and recorded in chapter 4, when they wrote and said, these people are causing trouble and you need to put a stop to this. Tatnai's report is very even-handed. There's none of the accusations. It's objective. It's straightforward. There's not any gushing flattery that we read in that earlier letter. There's an explanation from the Jews. They give their explanation honestly. They make any pejorative accusations against the Jews. And again, Ezra has credited the eye of God for his having adopted this attitude. Now, in verse 6, we have Tatnai's list of the writers, the people who are behind this letter, identifying themselves for having come. He adds, it's the same list that we found in verse 3, but he adds a word that's translated officials. D.J. Klein says that this word translated officials means imperial troubleshooters. They're the ones who came with the power to imprison or to punish. It starts off, now here's what it says. This is the copy, verse 6. This is the copy of the letter which Tatnai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar Bozanai, and his colleagues, the officials who were beyond the river, sent to Darius the king. All right, that's an introduction. Here's the letter. They sent a report to him in which it was written thus: to Darius the king, all peace. That expression, all peace, is means literally well-being completely. Okay, it seems to be that he's saying, we're doing well, we hope you are too. Don't get alarmed. Here's a problem. This may be a problem, but it's not an emergency. This isn't something to get too worked up about. It seems to be implied in the opening words. Tatnai wants the king. There's not any flattery there. It's just a statement that this is not necessarily bad news. All right? All peace. It's a salutation, but it's also a statement of status, that of how things are. Hope it's good. Things are good with you. It's going fine here. So basically what I've said here in number one, it indicates this letter is going to tell the king about something that needs the king's attention, but it's not necessarily a problem. Okay, king, we need you to take a look at this. We need your attention. You need put somebody on this thing to resolve a question that we have, but I don't know if it's going to be a problem. And he says they're in Judah watching construction of a temple. Let it be known to the king that we have gone to the province of Judah. This is not hearsay. We are there. We went to the province of Judah, we're there now, to the house of the great God, which is being built with huge stones, and beams are being laid in the walls, and this work is going on with great care, and is succeeding in their hands. All right, now, there's interesting things in the way he's worded all of this. Speaking of the house of the great God, that's not necessarily a statement of belief in God. It seems to be, again, rather typical of the Persians to speak of local deities in terms that would be consistent with the way the people who lived there would talk about their gods. Consistent, again, with Cyrus and how he had done. He wanted all the gods on his side. I don't think we should read too much into this as if the Persian kings or Tatnai or anybody else were necessarily believers. That goes too far. This language does not indicate that. They use other letters found in Persepolis and other places have indicated similar terms applied to other deities. Then it says, an expression translated huge stones here has again been difficult to interpret. It's been subject to various interpretations, let me say. Literally, the word translated huge or huge stones literally means stones of rolling. Stones of rolling, R-O-L-L-I-N-G. And so different translations and translation teams have handled it in different ways. They've made different assumptions about it. in the translators of the Septuagint that took it from the Hebrew to Greek in about the 3rd century B.C., about 250 years before Christ, they assumed that they're talking about the process of polishing a stone by tumbling it, stones of rolling. And so the Septuagint translates this as or the splendid. They use a word that means splendid or choice stones. In the apocryphal book of 1 Esdras, as translated in the King James Version copy of the Apocrypha, in 1 Esdras 6:9, it describes these stones as polished and costly. Again, the idea of their being rolled or tumbled to smooth them out. However, we have reason to believe that in this construction project, they use huge stones. It seems more likely that stones of rolling means these stones were too large to be carted in or carried in. They had to push them on rollers to get them to their positions. And so huge stones or great stones, as the King James renders, it seems more likely. So that's, again, a translation matter. Probably means very large stones. Now, the purpose of the timbers is not clear. Again, commentators disagree on what they're talking about. Some think they're talking about the rafters to support the roof. Yamauchi says it's talking about the interior paneling and the wainscoting that would go on inside. We know that they put that on the inside of the temple. But if either of those are the case, the project was probably further along than is implied. It would have to be rather nearing completion for them to be watching that going on. It's also possible that they were layering stone and timber in the construction, maybe to make it secure against earthquake, because they'd had problems with earthquakes in the region before. We don't know exactly. That's Brenneman's theory. Then the word translated that this project was going on with great care. King James translates it with speed, fast on. The project was moving, they were making fast progress. The New International says with diligence. It's another Persian word, not Hebrew. It has less to do with the speed of the progress than with the precision of the work. That it seems to be an emphasis on the precision care. This, they're making a really good job of this. They're being very careful in the construction that they're doing, and I want you to know about this, King. They're giving good attention to the details of the project and making good progress. It seems all to be a part of this. Well, he states that he's requested their authorization and he's asked them for their names. We asked, in verse 9, we asked those elders and said to them thus, who issued you a decree to build this temple and finish this structure? We also asked them their names so as to inform you, so that we might write down the names of the men who were at their head. Which again goes back to the statement before, and why I'm inclined to interpret that to mean that that's what happened previously. Tat and I wanted to let the king know the identity of the leaders of the construction project. He wanted a written record, and then he quotes their answer, but there are no names provided. He quotes their answer with no names. Look at verses 11 to 16. Thus they answered us, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and are rebuilding the temple that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and finished. But because our fathers had provoked the God of heaven to wrath, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon the Chaldean, who destroyed this temple and deported the people to Babylon. However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, King Cyrus issued a decree to rebuild this house of God. Also, the gold and silver utensils of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem and brought them to the temple of Babylon, these King Cyrus took from the temple of Babylon, and they were given to one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he had appointed governor. He said to him, take these utensils and go and deposit them in the temple in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be rebuilt in its place. Then that Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundations of the house of God in Jerusalem, and from then until now it has been under construction, and it is not yet completed. So this was their answer. Now, the fact that there are no names may or may not be significant. There are some who suggest that the returnees in chapter 2 is that list of names. I think that's extremely unlikely for a couple of reasons. For one thing, there aren't very many specific names in there. It gives you families and cities and numbers, but not very many specific names. If it's a list of names, it's not a very effective list of names. For another reason, he's not asking for an exhaustive list of names of everybody who contributed to the project. He just wants the names of the people who were leading the construction. And finally, the list in chapter 2 is 20 years old. It had to be badly out of date by now. There's a whole generation that's changed, okay, since then. Now, there are others who suggest that he sent the names on a separate under a separate heading, and that Ezra just decided to leave the list out. I don't think either one of those is most likely. What I suspect happened, I think the truth is, that Zerubbabel and Jeshua declined to give him the names. He said, who authorized this, and give me the names of everybody who's involved. And so they started by saying, look, we're servants of the Most High God, God of heaven and earth, and we're here to rebuild this temple. And this is what we're doing, and this is who authorized it. And he didn't give them the names, and he's given them an exact quote so that the king would understand that they didn't fully cooperate. But he's not necessarily making an accusation on that ground. They weren't exactly defiant, but they didn't provide a list of names. Other than the missing list of names, they gave a very good and complete answer to his question. They identified themselves, letter A, as servants of the God of heaven and earth, which is an expression with which the Persians would have been familiar. It meant that they believed in one supreme God who's not competing with any other. He's the God who is sovereign over all. They indicated that what they were doing was nothing new. It was a restoration project, not new construction. They were doing restoration, not new construction. This is an old building that had been built by a great king. Who was the great king that had built it? Solomon. This was a temple that had been built by a great king of Israel. It was Solomon from generations back. Some 500 years ago, Solomon built, or about 400 years ago, Solomon built this temple. And it's been destroyed, and we're just rebuilding it. It's not something new. It's not new construction. I think it's significant they did not rail at the Babylonians. Those evil Babylonians came in and tore it down, and now we've got to put it back up. They didn't say that. They explained God destroyed it because of their father's sins, and Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon was his tool. Okay. They just said, look, he was his tool. Essentially, they said, you know, our people brought this on ourselves, but thanks to Cyrus the king, we're here to rebuild. And they defended their work on the basis of a decree from Cyrus. That's the most important fact in their answer. It's the most important fact in the letter. Based it on the basis of a decree from Cyrus. Tattenai's big question was, who authorized this? Cyrus the Great, in his first year. Right, that goes back a ways, and that's a name that carries some weight in the Persian Empire, particularly to Darius, because to Darius, Cyrus was the great hero. He's the guy he wanted to emulate more than anybody else. He's the guy whose policies he was in the process of putting back in place. Now, he's called here, he's usually called the king of Persia. Here he's called the king of Babylon. And there are some who stumble over that. He was actually king of Persia. He wouldn't have called him king of Babylon. It seems likely, though, that what happened was, he, rather than making it sound distant as if he's the king of that area over there called Persia, well, it's a reminder of who's in charge here now. Okay, that this used to be Babylonian-controlled territory, and it was the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed this place. Cyrus came in and took his place and is now king over this region, and he's the one who told us we could do this. He says that Nebuchadnezzar had stolen all of the gold and silver items from the worship of the in this temple. Note, it's significant but it's easy for us to miss, that in any other cultural context, they would have talked about the images that were taken from the temple. But there were no images to be taken from this temple because God had forbidden the construction of graven images. They didn't have images of their God. They just had a place to worship their God. And they had tools for his worship. They had no images. So they weren't asking for any images to be returned to them. Now, it says that all those utensils have been given by Cyrus to Sheshbazzar. So here's that name again. And it causes a lot of confusion for commentators who wonder, you know, well, what happened to Sheshbazzar and why is there no record of his death? And it's possible that he was another guy who just is kind of a mysterious figure that shows up early and who gets mentioned again here. But again, the simplest explanation is to accept the Jewish tradition that Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel are the same guy, because both of them are credited with having laid the foundation of the temple. And so it's probably that Zerubbabel is the one who had the name Sheshbazzar that when the things were issued to him. And they would use Sheshbazzar's name here because that's what the name would say in the decree that Cyrus had issued. They admitted that the construction was not yet complete. The construction is not yet complete. The second half of verse 16 is almost an apology, I think, to Tattenai and King Darius. Look, King Cyrus the Great authorized this. He told us to get here and get it done, and we haven't succeeded in finishing the work. We should have, but we dropped the ball, and we're finally back on it, and we're trying to finish the project that Cyrus commissioned us to complete. That seems to be the tone of what they've said. Well, having reported the answer that the Jews gave to his inquiries, in the closing sentence of the letter, the last verse of the chapter, we read this. Now, if it pleases the king, this is Tattenai's request. He introduces it, he tells them what he asked and what they answered, and then he makes this request. If it pleases the king, let a search be conducted in the king's treasure house, which is there in Babylon, if it be that a decree was issued by King Cyrus to rebuild this house of God in Jerusalem, and let the king send to us his decision concerning this matter. He makes a simple request for an archival search for the decree, for a copy of the decree. Search for a copy of the decree. It may sound odd that he asked him to search the treasure house, which is there in Babylon, for a copy of a nearly 20-year-old edict and the king who was probably in Susa. Why would he ask him to search in Babylon? Well, when the decree was issued from Babylon and Cyrus was in Babylon when he issued the decree, it seems unlikely they would bother hauling that back to Susa, where he set up his capital later. And so he suggested that maybe it would be found there in Babylon. And the kings of Persia saw their imperial records, their chronicles, as some of their greatest treasures, and so they kept it within their treasuries, in their treasure house. It would be stored with the valuables there. So it seems that they would assume the most likely place to find this would be in Babylon. He doesn't bother saying, you know, if it's not there, maybe it's in Susa. Don't know how long they had to hunt, but we'll find out in the next chapter it was not in either one of those places. They will eventually find it, but they won't find it in either of those places. It was not in Babylon, and it was not in in Susa. They found it, they found it in Ecbatana, in a fortress there. And so they had to search a few extra places before they found it. It took them a little time, but they went looking for this decree and at the request of Tattenai. And he told them, you can keep building until we get word. That still strikes me as remarkable. And it struck Ezra as remarkable as well. Here are a couple of lessons, or three lessons, to draw from this as we conclude this chapter. First of all, we're reminded once again that God supervises his people and directs events. I'll say this over and over again during this history study in Ezra and Esther and Nehemiah. God is supervising his people. He's directing events on a grand scale. It was he who brought about the destruction of the original temple. It was he who had moved Cyrus to decree its reconstruction. To do the first, he raised up Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire to use as his tool. To accomplish the second, he destroyed the Babylonian Empire so that the Persians could come in and do his will. The Babylonian Empire lasted for 70 years, which was exactly the period of time God intended his people to be out of the land. He raised them up and brought them down for his purposes on a grand scale. God was supervising his people and directing events. So we see a lot of the broad strokes of God's providence in this chapter. It was he who prompted Tattenai then, on a smaller scale perhaps, to be reasonable, to be patient, to allow them to keep working for the months it's going to take for the search for this decree, for the message to get back there, and for the search to be made, and for the king to make his decision, and for word to get back. It's going to take a while. We also see a vivid illustration of faith and obedience. Faith and obedience is the proper response to God's word. When the prophets Haggai and Zechariah preached to the people, they got busy. When Tattenai showed up and things got a little scary, they stayed at it. When Tattenai started saying, I need the names of whoever's doing this work and whoever's in charge of this project, they said, you know what, let's see what the king says. And they didn't. That seems they didn't even give him the names. And nobody got nervous and went home to hide. Everybody kept working. They kept making progress. They kept getting the work done. Faith and obedience are the proper response to God's word. Another, a third lesson, our confidence, us today, our confidence in future glory comes from understanding theology and history. Understanding theology and history. As for theology, we have to understand something of the person and the nature of God. We have to know something about who he is. We have to understand something of our own sinfulness and the consequences of our sin. We have to understand something of God's grace. All of those things are on display in this chapter. The people had sinned. God had destroyed the temple. We're trying to do what's right, what God gave us to do, and we want to honor him. And God, in his grace, is allowing that to happen. Every believer, I'm convinced every believer needs a good grasp, not just on what we should believe and what we should do, but why we believe what we believe and why we do what we do. Part of the problem in the church today is we've not done a very good job of communicating why we believe this and why we do this to the rising generations. And as for understanding history and why that's important, Brenneman put it this way, quote, the Christian faith is tied to the fact that God made promises and fulfilled them in history, exemplified by Jesus, who actually came, died, and rose again, end quote. You know, as we continue to see what's going on here in the history of Israel, we continue to see the literal fulfillment of God's promises to ancient Israel. And in seeing that, we gain a steadfast confidence in the anticipation that he's going to continue to answer literally and continue to fulfill literally the promises he made all those years ago to Israel and to others. Those promises are yet to be fulfilled, and they will one day be fulfilled. There is a rising tide in evangelical Christianity that wants to rethink the promises of God and to reinterpret the promises of God as having already been fulfilled historically, and people are turning their backs on the dispensational view of God's return and Christ's coming kingdom, and people all over the place. Somebody sent me recently a statement from another denominational group that has historically been dispensational and looking for a premillennial return of Christ for the church to establish his kingdom. And they've backed away from that. The Evangelical Free Church has backed away from that now. They've officially said, we don't want to include that in our statement of faith anymore because there's too much dispute over it. And I would agree that we can disagree on this, that people who love God and love his word take a different position on this. But I think it's important that we continue, and so you'll hear me say this over and over again, because it's becoming the dominant opinion among evangelical Christians today, that God's already kept his promise to bring the kingdom and we're just waiting for eternity, and that we're living in the kingdom now. And I just don't see that. I don't believe that. I believe there is a literal fulfillment of promises yet to be, and we see more and more evidence in our study of the Old Testament how God has worked in the past, and it should give us confidence that he is going to continue working that way in the future. And those promises he made to Israel, he will in fact fulfill to Israel. Let's pray.